We know that it'll bring a return to the rest of the country, because whatever you do, it's going to be good for everybody.
Kodiak gets a boost from the federal government in an effort to use more renewable energy. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 26th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a spike in illegal firewood cutting near Fairbanks.
Whether it be people not knowing what's required or doing it maliciously, it's unknown.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
A group of Democratic U.S. senators are speaking out against proposed changes to the Endangered Species Act. The Bush administration announced earlier this month that it plans to revise the law that protects America's wildlife. It would be the biggest overhaul to the act since 1986. From Washington, D.C., APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Seven Democratic senators signed on to a letter expressing strong concern about the proposed changes. They sent it Monday to Interior Department Secretary Dirk Kempthorne, who's pushing the revision. The senators include Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, and Barbara Boxer, and represent East Coast states and California. The letter urges Secretary Kempthorne to withdraw the proposal. It says the changes are inconsistent with the Act's purpose and go against past court decisions. The senators say the proposal would, quote, reduce rather than strengthen protections for imperiled fish and wildlife. Secretary Kempthorne has called the proposal a narrow change that would streamline the regulatory process and, quote, provide clarity and certainty. The proposal says that federal agencies looking to do construction or development projects would be able to make more decisions without an independent review from the Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Marine Fisheries Service. It says federal agencies now have the experience to decide for themselves if their plans will harm vulnerable species. The Interior Department says it's just not an efficient use of limited resources to review actions when the potential effects are either insignificant or have only a remote risk of causing jeopardy or destruction of critical habitat. Kempthorne says cleaning up the process will help the federal government focus its attention on protecting the truly endangered species. The changes were inspired, in part, by the listing in May of the polar bear as a threatened species. The bear's sea ice habitat is shrinking from warming temperatures. But Kempthorne says the Endangered Species Act is not the way to regulate global warming, and the revisions would prevent that from happening. The proposal uses an example. It says when a federal agency funds a new highway, vehicles using the road might increase greenhouse gas emissions. But the proposal says while local air pollution could be a result to consider, the tailpipe emissions contribution to global warming would not. So the federal agency wouldn't have to worry about the effects of those impacts on endangered species. It says the building of one highway is, quote, an insignificant contributor to any global warming. In addition to the seven Democrats signed on to the letter protesting the changes, environmentalists are up in arms over the plan. They say the guidelines favor big industry at the expense of protecting animals and say the Bush administration is trying to force last-minute changes before leaving office. The public has until September 15th to comment. Senator Barbara Boxer of California plans to hold an oversight hearing in late September, and she's requested that Secretary Kempthorne testify. However, the hearing will happen more than a week after the public comment period closes. The Democrats speaking out against the changes say at the very least, the Interior Department should extend the public comment period from 1 month to six, so there's time to hold public hearings around the country. In Washington, D.C., I'm Libby Casey.
Kodiak Electric Association has received a big boost in its efforts to purchase the Terror Lake Hydro Plant from the Four Dam Pool. A $38 million loan from the United States Department of Agriculture's Rural Utility Service announced on Monday will go a long way toward ensuring that KEA will reach its goal of 95% renewable energy by the year 2020. KMXT's Casey Kelly reports.
The USDA rolled out all the stops for the announcement. The head of the agency's Rural Utility Service in Washington, D.C., Jim Andrew, made the trip to Kodiak to present KEA officials with a giant check for $38 million. Andrew says the agency sees this benefiting not just Kodiak, but the rest of the country as well.
We view this as an investment in Kodiak and the co-op and the people around here. And we know that it will bring a return to the rest of the country, because whatever you do, it's going to be good for everybody.
Andrew says the nation is starting to realize that it needs renewable energy. Soaring fuel prices have many utilities seeking out projects that will wean customers from diesel-generated power, and he says rural electric agencies have been at the forefront.
For years, we've been setting aside $200 million out of our base of about $4 billion. We've been setting aside for renewable projects, and nobody ever wanted them, but suddenly they're waking up to it. And I'll say, frankly, the rural electrics are leading the charge on this by far.
Cliff Davidson, chairman of the KEA Board of Directors, says USDA supported the Terror Lake Hydro Project from the beginning, and the loan represents the next step in securing the board's goal of 95% renewable energy within 12 years.
And we're well on that track, and this will certainly help get us there in much shorter time than if we had to do it without your partnership.
Terror Lake is currently owned by the Four Dam Pool, a collective that includes four hydro plants that service the communities of Ketchikan, Wrangell, and Petersburg in southeast Alaska, as well as Glen Allen, Valdez, and Kodiak in south central. KEA Executive Director Darren Scott says the loan should cover the entire cost of purchasing the hydro plant from the pool. Owning Terror Lake, he says, will make it easier for the co-op to move forward with future renewable energy projects, such as a wind farm slated to go into operation on top of Pillar Mountain next year.
Owning Terror Lake and being able to make that the foundation or the cornerstone of that goal allows that to happen. Not owning it makes it more difficult to have happen. So our long-term goal, again, is to get off of diesel as best as possible and move to the future, and this is a large step in that.
KEA was already working on the agreement to purchase Terror Lake before the loan announcement. Scott says the co-op has settled on the financial terms of the deal and will be seeking approval from other pool members by the end of the year.
We felt we had the loan coming, and it's good, and it definitely solidifies that financial position or our financial obligation to move forward on it. What we've got now is a date set for December 31st in the asset transfer agreement to get things going, so it should help. We've carried through on our obligations here to get the loan secured, so it does help the process for sure.
He says the loan will be paid back over 30 years with a fixed low interest rate. In addition to presenting KEA with the loan check, USDA officials had a chance to tour the Terror Lake facility, located 25 air miles southwest of Kodiak City, during their trip to the island. In Kodiak, I'm Casey Kelly.
The scramble to find dry firewood has some Fairbanks area residents poaching trees on public lands. Northern Area State Parks Chief Ranger Matt McClure says he's seeing more illegal firewood harvesting than normal in the Chena River State Recreation Area east of Fairbanks.
Whether it be people not knowing what's required or doing it maliciously, it's unknown. But there's definitely an increase of illegal wood removal compared to years prior. So we're trying to educate the public and basically let people know where they can cut, what they can cut, and what's required to cut.
McClure says non-commercial woodcutting is allowed in the recreation area between September 15th and April 15th if you purchase a $50 permit and follow a few basic rules. He says harvest is limited to burned or downed trees at least 50 yards from the road and a quarter mile from any developed campsite or trailhead. Fairbanks North Star Borough Land Management Specialist Carrie Shaw says there's also illegal cutting happening on borough lands.
I really believe that folks are cutting illegally because the locations where the state and the borough have to cut wood are really far from town. You're talking about maybe a half a tank of gas to go up. We're hearing from the public that they're very nervous, and we're trying to meet the need, and it's very difficult.
Shaw says firewood cutting is allowed on a few remote parcels across the borough at a cost of $5 a cord. She says cutting is limited to areas with available dead trees, safe access, and where it's compatible with adjacent land uses and ownership. Shaw says the borough has always offered wood cutting permits, but interest has spiked with the cost of oil this summer.
In the past, we maybe gave out 5 permits per year. This season so far, we're almost at 100.
Shaw says the borough will open additional lands to firewood cutting after freeze-up when wet areas become accessible. Another upcoming option for people needing to supplement their wood supply will be at the Chena River Flood Control Project. Project manager John Shockey says a lot of wood was collected when floodgates were lowered earlier this month.
259 26 cubic yard side dump trucks, and that's a lot of material. Now, of course, some of that is good firewood, some of it is literally unusable debris. But nevertheless, there is a lot of wood estimated by our senior ranger to be 200-250 cords at least.
Shockey says people interested in gathering the free wood need to call the Flood Control Project office beginning September 17th to get on a list. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Kodiak resident stars in a nationwide ad campaign.
This has been a really fun and exciting experience. Definitely unexpected.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, providing tax-advantaged college savings options for Alaska families. T. Rowe Price Investment Services Incorporated, distributor underwriter. Information at 1-888-4, and then Alaska. And by
First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Though 2010 is more than a year away, the U.S. Census Bureau is already making plans in Alaska for its once-a-decade survey of the American population. KBBI's Mike Mason has the story.
During last week's Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly meeting, the Assembly received an update on the planning efforts for the census from Chuck McGee, who's a census partnership specialist. He says the early planning for the census should result in a more complete and accurate census of the state of Alaska.
In Census 2000, the state of Alaska had the lowest rate of return of census forms of any state in the United States. This was not good for the Census Bureau. It was not good for you and I, the taxpayer, because when a person does not return their form, the Census Bureau must advertise, recruit, hire, train, and send an employee out to the house to acquire the information.
The population numbers that come out of the census are used to determine congressional representation. They're also often used in the distribution of federal funding. McGee says the state of Alaska also uses the census numbers in several ways.
To determine political boundaries and reapportioning political boundaries in the state that can affect, deeply affect the Kenai Peninsula Borough. Plus, the state uses those figures additionally to distribute certain funding sources such as revenue sharing and timber receipts and other sources of funding.
The Census Bureau will be opening up a main office in Anchorage to cover the entire state, and they anticipate having a staff of around 250 people once 2010 rolls around. Statewide, the Census Bureau will be employing roughly 5,000 people, and they are committed to hiring primarily Alaskans for those jobs. Currently, the recruiting effort for those jobs is being handled through the Regional Census Center in Seattle until the Anchorage office is opened. An interesting note about the census in Alaska is that the very first person counted nationwide is from Alaska, and that person will be personally counted by the director of the Census Bureau in January of 2010. In the year 2000, the first person counted as part of the census was from Unalakleet. McGee confirms that the census in remote and rural parts of Alaska will begin in January of 2010, as opposed to April of 2010 when it begins everywhere else.
We want to get into the rural villages and do the enumeration there before breakup, before people start going out for jobs elsewhere and before people go to fish camp and whatnot.
McGee confirms that in the year 2000, the census effort undertaken within the Kenai Peninsula Borough missed nearly 270 people, which McGee characterized as a very good rate of error compared to other parts of the state. McGee says the census forms that will be sent to residents are shorter than they have been for previous counting efforts.
The first person in each residence will answer 10 questions. All remaining residents will fill out 7 questions. It could be done rapidly. It's easy, simple to understand, and should go very quickly. This, in comparison with previous census, when every fifth household received a census form that was from 76 to 78 questions long and was quite involved and could take quite a long time to complete the form.
McGee confirms that the personal information collected from the census forms is kept confidential for 72 years and is not available to other government or non-government agencies or organizations.
The only circumstance by which we will release the information is if an individual needs to prove that they were in a particular place during a particular census period or gain information from that for purposes of obtaining a birth certificate from the state of Alaska. They can request the information about themselves from the Census Bureau, and the Census Bureau will research the records and gather the information. And actually, in Alaska, that is quite common.
You can find additional information on the upcoming 2010 census online at census.gov. In Homer, I'm Mike Mason.
Last night, the Anchorage School Board approved the calendars for the next 2 years. And despite considerable protest, the district says the academic advantages of the August start outweigh the problems it causes some families. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The calendars are for the 2009-2010 and 2010-2011 school years. From mid-July through the first week of August, they were posted on the Anchorage School District website for public comment. School Board member Tim Steele said the proposed calendars attracted considerable response.
I want the public to understand that we have received a lot of comments, both pro and con, and we do have a pretty good size compilation, if you will, in the in with our package.
The package information supplied by the administration on the calendars totaled 10 pages. Public comments reprinted from the website were 38 pages. The dominant theme woven within those responses was the same one voiced last night by Chugach High School teacher Brian Mason.
It seems to me that the district is completely ignoring the cultural practices of many of its students and staff. Starting school in mid-August has caused direct conflict with fall subsistence activities, and I fear that it is our students that are paying the price.
Mason said since the early start began 2 years ago, many parents have told him they're frustrated by having to choose between subsistence activities and the beginning of school. He said these activities are not just cultural. Families need the food for winter. Economic necessity dictates student attendance.
During the first 4 days of this current school year, I have been told by no fewer than 10 students that they will be missing all or portions of the next 2 weeks. I have another 5 students who are on my roster, but who I have not seen yet.
Mason, who's a science instructor, says these early absences come at a time when he's teaching the basic concepts of his classes and, equally important, the basics of laboratory safety. The majority of the comments posted on the district's website protested the early start. A few praised it. So did the board's student representative, Jose Del Real of East High, who said many students appreciated that when the December-January holiday break took place, they no longer had homework to do because the fall semester was over.
I've heard it from other students. There seems to be overwhelming support for the move. We're happy to have a vacation. Not to mention the fact that we get off of school 2 weeks earlier in May when the weather tends to be a little bit nicer than in August.
In last night's board-approved calendar, next year's first day of classes is August 19th, and for the 2010-2011 school year, it's August 18th. The last day of classes in the spring is May 19th and May 20th. The first semester ends with the winter holiday break. Mason had prefaced his remarks concerning the traditional summer activities by saying he understood the calendar's academic and vacation advantages, especially concerning the mandated testing associated with the federal No Child Left Behind Act. Anchorage School Superintendent Carol Como also said that the various tests demanded by the federal and state departments of education had influenced the early starts, and thus increase the already existing conflict with family August activities.
It's really important to get as much instruction time in, and we have these and always have had kids coming and going for hunting and subsistence activities even before the calendar was ever changed for years.
Como said the earlier August class starts were a statewide pattern.
all the school districts in the state, with the exception of Juneau, which is moving to start a week earlier next year, and Kenai is moving to be closer to us, and Sitka is moving. They are the last. Everybody else actually starts earlier. And they have loads of people impacted by subsistence activities.
Como agreed with the board's suggestion that data concerning student absences in August, as well as family surveys on the early start, should be collected. Subsistence was not the only issue either impacted by or influencing the school calendar formation. The committee charged with creating the calendar listed 35 issues, including test dates, sports events, religious holidays, parent conferences, and teacher staff in-service days. This is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
The National Park Service is seeking input on the future of traffic on the road into Denali National Park. The agency is holding meetings this month as it develops options for addressing increased visitor demand. Park spokeswoman Chris Pfister says changes are being considered to the bus system, which moves people around the park.
The bus system has worked for a long time, but the numbers of buses have increased over the years, and now we are getting close to hitting that limit of buses and all vehicles that we have as part of the general management plan.
Pfister says the Park Service wants to determine whether the traffic limits make sense in terms of wildlife impacts and visitor experience. She says the park needs good science as it faces rising interest from tourism companies seeking to funnel more people into the park.
Much of the demand has come from the tourism industry and increasing, particularly the tour buses that go out there. Those buses are pretty much at capacity now. There are allocations of seats given to particularly the cruise industry based on their previous year's use.
Pfister says with tour buses at capacity, there's more pressure on park shuttle buses designed for independent travelers. The study is looking at the number and size of buses as well as agency and traffic from private vehicles permitted to drive the road. Pfister says the park wants to get the public's opinion on the situation, but is also trying to gauge effects on wildlife.
We can't pull the animals, but we have been able to attach collars with GPS units to about 20 bears one season and 20 sheep last year. And so we can monitor their movements throughout the course of the summer and get some idea if there's some change in their movements, whether it be from day, from night, time of the year in terms of more bus traffic.
Pfister says preliminary data shows wildlife is more active when traffic is low. The Park Service will hold public meetings on the issue of traffic on the Denali National Park Road throughout September. Pfister says the range of options developed will be considered in an environmental impact study. Vaseline brand lotion has chosen Kodiak as the main location to produce an ad campaign for a new product. One local will be the star of the campaign, but it will also include many more Kodiak residents. KMXT's Mary Donaldson has more.
Stacy Bright is the Senior Communications Marketing Manager for Unilever, the makers of Vaseline. Their new product is the Intensive Rescue Clinical Therapy Skin Protectant Body Lotion that can be bought over-the-counter without a doctor's prescription. She says choosing Kodiak as the location to begin their latest advertising campaign was easy since it's a tight-knit community where word of mouth travels fast.
It is one of the most beautiful places I have ever set foot on. Alaska really, really represents this iconic cold weather and the different extremes and climates. And we felt like the people here in Kodiak probably had to combat a lot of dry skin. So we thought this was a great place to come. As we looked at a lot of different towns and cities in Alaska, we learned about Kodiak and we came and we met a lot of the different people here in town. And we thought it was such an incredibly close-knit community. We thought this was a perfect place to launch our new Vaseline campaign.
Kodiak resident Petal Roosh is going to be the star in the ad campaign. Bright says Roosh was chosen because she seemed to embody many of the characteristics of a Kodiak person and had a need for their new product. Roosh says she just found out her role in the campaign on Thursday.
This has been a really fun and exciting experience, definitely unexpected, and I was really tickled to be chosen to be a featured person in the Vaseline campaign.
She says all she had to do was try the new product, and if she liked it, to tell someone else to try it. She says she can't put a number on how many recommendations she's made, but that she had many friends and family members trying the product.
So I prescribed it to everyone, basically all of my friends, all of my family, and all these people do various forms of work, you know, fishing, shopkeepers, dentists, doctors. So it's kind of neat to see it spread through the whole community at this point.
Bright says their camera crews are shooting many different locations around Kodiak for commercials due out this fall.
Our shooting has really been determined by the residents of Kodiak. The Vaseline team has really gone and wanted to see them in the places that they work and they live. We've gone to people's homes. We've gone where people do different sport activities. We've been all over Kodiak and really fortunate ourselves to get to experience the entire town ourselves.
Roosh says having cameras follow her around has been kind of fun. Her longest day of filming was 13 hours.
You know, just having that sort of experience, having people do that. You watch TV yourself and see that happening to other people is very strange when it's happening to you. But I have to say that it was a really pleasant experience for myself and my family, and all the people were very thoughtful about us and our space. So it's been a lot of fun.
She says taking part in the campaign has been a wonderful experience and kind of surreal.
I think it's, I don't think it's quite hit me yet, and I'm just really excited, and I think that it's going to be really wonderful to see our whole community in a commercial and see all your friends' faces and, you know, to kind of see how our community is received elsewhere, because I think people really are curious and don't necessarily know how we live our lives here. So I think it'll be a really wonderful thing for the rest of the world to see Kodiak.
Bright says the commercial should be on national television by October, with other types of ads going up on Vaseline's website, which will include short video clips, pictures, and audio, all to promote their latest product. I'm Mary Donaldson.
The long-planned replacement of the aging Fairview Manor apartment complex in Fairbanks is underway. Heavy equipment has demolished and is clearing away the first of three large U-shaped low-income apartment buildings to make way for new units. The other Fairview buildings, which still have residents, will be taken down in later stages of the project. Local architect Charles Bettisworth with the Weeks Field Development Group says new buildings will begin going up this fall.
We got to do some excavations and some fill for foundations. We got to get the utilities in. I would say it would be probably mid-September when we see the first foundations in. The goal is to get the buildings framed up and closed in before cold winter sets in and then finish them out in the spring.
Bettisworth says the first construction phase includes 74 units with another 50 to follow in coming years. He says the apartments will provide vastly updated, safer, and more energy-efficient housing for those who have trouble affording a place to live in Fairbanks. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Mary Donaldson in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Mike Mason in Homer, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Eli Menneker. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at APRN.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.